Hey there, I'm Rachel.
And I'm Jessica, and this is All Things Sensory by Harkla. Together, we're on a mission to help children, families, therapists, and educators live happy, healthy lives.
We dive into all things sensory, special needs, occupational therapy, parenting, self-care, and so much more. In each episode, we share raw, honest, fun ideas and strategies for everyone to implement into daily life.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, hello. Welcome, everyone. You're listening to All Things Sensory by Harkla with your good friends, Rachel and Jessica. And this is episode 152.
All right. We are having a great conversation with Dr. Sam Zink. And I just really like his name.
Now, what's cool about Dr. Zink is he is actually the dentist who released Tripp's tongue tie. So if you've been following my personal journey, I'm Rachel, by the way, if you don't know my voice, if you've been following my
journey, by the way,
152 episodes into it.
Come on, guys.
You should know, unless you're new. If you're not a longtime lifer listener, then you might not know our voices, but I'm Rachel, and I have shared our journey on Instagram at the Sensory Project 208. So if you aren't familiar with that journey, Dr. Zink is the one who released Tripp's tongue tie several weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's what we're going to talk about with him today. He's going to give us all the details on tongue ties and lip ties and fascia and
adult tongue ties and lip ties and how those are imperative to look into. And so before you click out of this, if you're like, oh, my child doesn't have a tongue tie or I don't have a tongue tie, just listen.
Just listen.
With an open mind.
Just listen.
Good morning. Good morning. We have Dr. Zink here with us today. How are you?
Doing good. How are you doing?
Oh, we're so good.
Doing good. Yes. We're excited to have you this morning to talk about all things tongue ties, lip ties. You were actually the dentist who released Tripp's tongue tie and lip tie, so we have kind of a special connection and we can share. There's no like HIPAA or anything here. You have my permission to share.
Good call.
Yeah.
Good call.
I've released my information.
But before we start talking about that, we do have five secret questions that we ask all of our guests on the podcast. So we're going to start with that.
Great. All right. First question. Would you rather ride a bike or a scooter up a 1 mile hill?
Scooter.
Oh,
interesting.
Okay.
I would do a bike.
I would
ride my bike. I mean, I've done it before.
Oh.
No.
It's not motorized?
No. Like the one that you have one foot on and you use your other foot to go.
Oh, I was thinking like one of those electronic scooters you ride around down to the Boy Scout.
Yeah, well, obviously we'd choose that one if that was the case. Next question.
What do you eat for breakfast?
I don't eat breakfast.
Oh.
What?
Do you do fasting? Is that what it is?
Yeah, intermittent fasting.
Okay.
So what do you eat for breakfast at 2 o'clock in the afternoon?
So I've been doing the carnivore diet, so I usually have like a steak for lunch, but I've also been doing like a 4 hour feeding window. So I eat between like 2 and 6.
Oh, wow. That's hard. I don't think
it's not a hard one to get going with it. You know, you start your body adapts to it.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. I could ask so many more questions, but we'll move on. So you have a couple of kids, correct?
Yeah, three boys.
Three boys. Which one is your favorite?
Oh, boy. You know what you're supposed to say? They're all my favorite.
Yeah, it's not true, though.
Coming from child here, okay.
Who only has one child.
Exactly.
You know, they're 5, 8, and 11. And it seems like the youngest, he's staying younger longer. And we're kind of like cherishing him, like, oh, he's still little boy, snuggly. So I'm enjoying that.
That's fair.
I like that.
Okay.
All right. Now I can ask my question. What is your favorite book?
Oh, I'd say I like A Pattern Language by Christopher Alexander. It's actually like a book about architecture, and it has all these different patterns about buildings and construction and homes. And yeah, so really, I really like that stuff.
Interesting.
All right.
Okay.
Okay. Last question. What is your sensory quirk?
What's an example of a sensory quirk?
Like, for me, I'm a little sensitive to sound, and so I don't like it when there's, like, competing noises in the background. So if the TV's on and I'm trying to have a conversation, that's my sensory quirk, one of my sensory quirks.
It reminds me of, like, the fact that my wife likes the stereo to be almost imperceptibly loud, you know, like, quiet, like, you can't even hear it.
Oh.
And I want it really loud so I can, like, hear the music. And so it's sort of a battle sometimes.
Always a battle.
Yeah.
Oh, can that be a quirk? Is it I like music loud?
Yes, definitely.
Sure.
A seeker. You seek that auditory input.
Yeah.
We'll give it to you.
Yeah, I mean, I want the stereo to sound like a real performance, like imaging and sound stage. And you have to turn it up so that it can perform. If it's just quiet, it's like, it just sounds like noise. So
that's fair.
You like loud concerts then?
To a point, yeah.
Okay.
Maybe not like rock concerts going to damage your ears, but definitely like live concerts with good acoustics is really cool. Actually, I went to dental school in Louisville, Kentucky, and there's some really cool venues there. There's this one called The Palace, and it's an old like 1920s movie palace with like really crazy carvings in the ceiling and sort of a theme of like a Spanish villa inside. And it has like a blue ceiling with like little fiber optic lights that look like stars.
That's cool.
They recorded a bunch of concerts there. Like, I think one is Alison Krauss and Union Station. It's like their favorite venue. But we went to several concerts with this. I think it seats maybe like 2,000. But you feel really close to the stage. And then I went to this like concert at the arena. I'm never going to an arena concert again. I like the movie palace or opera house size. Because acoustics are really good. And it's just that you feel like you're close to the stage.
Oh, yeah. I feel the same way. I hate going to concerts at like Taco Bell Arena. I hate it.
Yeah. You're just like watching a video screen. I'm like, might as well just watch it on TV.
Exactly.
Yes.
Excellent. Okay.
All right. So now that we all know your deepest, darkest secrets, tell us what you do, how you do it, why you do it, who you are, all those things.
I'm a general dentist. Actually, I worked in IT before I became a dentist, so I switched careers. We lived here in Boise, Idaho when I worked in the IT field, and my wife is a dental hygienist, or was. She retired when her first son was born, but I came home one night after almost being done with my MBA and said, hey, I think I'm going to go to dental school. So it was a big life reboot where I went back for prerequisites, anatomy and physiology and biochemistry and all that good stuff for about a year and a half. And then we went out to Louisville, Kentucky, and we were gone for about 12 years before moving back to Treasure Valley, the Boise, Idaho area. My first son was born right when I finished like my last semester of dental school. And then my second son was born in South Carolina, and then my third son was born in Oregon. And then, you know, we just came back to Boise about 2 years ago. A big reason to move back to Boise was closer to family, and then I always wanted to have my own practice. So previously I worked for more of like a corporate dental type organization. I was able to start up from scratch my own practice here in Boise and basically limit it to or focus on tongue tie and airway.
Why did you decide to focus on that?
Well, that does go back to my kids, actually. So my oldest son, when he was born, actually, every time I see a patient after this, we have this intake form. Okay, it is, wow, my son had all these baby symptoms except for two. He was gaining weight. So that's, and the other thing was colic, so he didn't really have colic. But he had all these other symptoms, and my wife had all the mother symptoms, and we had no clue. She nursed him for over 2 years, and I just think, like, wow, it was really rough. Like, he had really poor sleep and reflux, and my wife had severe pain, and I just think, on all the people we interacted with, medical professionals, no one ever mentioned anything. And I was, like I said, I was a semester away from graduating dental school, and I had no clue. My second son had a lot of the same symptoms, not as many, but I think it's because my wife had learned to compensate special pillows and positioning, and she just was more skilled at it. And then it wasn't until my third son was born that it got our attention, because he was diagnosed with failure to thrive. At 3 weeks old, he was only 8 ounces of birth weight. Mm-hmm. And then had the procedure done, and he bounced back so well. I got to go back and watch the laser lipid tongue tie release, but I thought, I need to learn how to do this so I can help people not experience what we went through with our first few children not having any help or awareness. It just seems like there's a big gap in the community in general, but especially within the medical community. Like maybe you kind of think, maybe your doctor or your pediatrician or your dentist might know about this, but it's not always the case. Or I would say it's more often than not that, you know, I know for me, I didn't receive any specific tongue tie training. I mean, we had knew what a tongue tie or frenulum was with anatomy and physiology, but there wasn't really discussions about the symptoms or the functional issues with breastfeeding or with how a tongue tie would affect an adult.
It's so interesting. And as we were preparing for our discussion with you, I actually thought in my head, I was like, I wonder how many kids who are diagnosed with failure to thrive, it's because they have a tongue tie.
Yeah, something that's come up recently has been pretty interesting is there's been some kiddos that were headed for feeding tubes that didn't have to go on a feeding tube, or a few that were on a feeding tube were able to come off the feeding tube because of the tongue tie release.
Oh, that's incredible.
Wow. It's frustrating to me as a medical professional myself, and I missed the signs too for my own little guy. And it was on my radar, but he was eating, he was nursing, I wasn't in pain. Like, he didn't have a ton of symptoms. And I thought that everything was going fine, but I had no idea.
That's sneaky. It can be sneaky. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think there's this idea too out there that if your child is colicky or if they're not sleeping well, that those things are just normal.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's important to remember there's a big difference between normal and common, or I would say like optimal. So we want to have a vision for what optimal health looks like. And I think that's a big thing that's missing in the medical field, especially when you talk about people in different specialties, because we see, you know, whatever your specialty is, we see extreme cases of not well. So even you can get even more focused on other patients that have such terrible problems, they're extremely symptomatic, then someone that's quote normal seems fine, but they're not fine. Mm-hmm. You have to know that kind of whole spectrum from severe disease to optimal health. And often like our view is so skewed that we can't see the actual problem.
Yeah. I like that term, optimal health.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good quote that we'll have to pull out.
Yeah. I wrote it down.
So for our listeners who maybe don't know exactly what a tongue tie is, can you just give us a brief overview of like what a tongue tie is, a lip tie, and what that looks like?
Yeah. One of the terms that's a newer term that I think is really good to use is an oral restriction. So there is, in my opinion, too much focus on the appearance of these structures, the tongue tie, lip tie, buccal tie, but they are fascia or connective tissue that will gather into one spot. So like with a lip tie, if you flip the lip of a baby up, you might see some people call it like a string, which it's not literally a string, but it's a metaphor. There's like a tissue that looks kind of like a string shape. Sometimes you'll even see like the tissue will blanch or turn white when you try to lift the lip. And the buccal ties are basically the same thing as under the upper lip, but on the sides. And I tell people, it's kind of like if you see someone smile and they have a dimple in their cheeks, that's actually the buccal tie causing that little dimple on the outside of the cheek.
Wait, so hold on. Hold on. You're saying that dimples are
crazy?
What?
Yes. It's wild.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that it's, quote, a tie. I mean, that's why I don't go as much by the appearance, because you can have pulls and have a buccal tie, but if it's not impacting function, if it's not causing a limitation of the functional range of motion, it's not causing symptoms, and that doesn't mean it's a problem that needs to be treated. So this is the nuance of where there could be anatomic structures, but they may or may not be causing a problem that warrants treatment.
Right.
So interesting, right?
Yeah. So, and then the tongue tie is a little trickier, I think, because it can be harder to see because the tongue is a really dynamic structure. There's lots of muscles and cranial nerves. It's very mobile. So depending on the posture of the tongue, you may or may not see a visible frenulum. So most medical and dental professionals would agree that there's a certain type of tongue tie, which goes to the very tip of the tongue. And everybody goes, oh yeah, that's a tongue tie. But a lot of the most severely restrictive or type of ties that limit function can be virtually invisible. And those things they call a posterior submucosal tie. And those you really have to do a functional lift of the tongue to see if that fascia is gathering up, and then you can sort of visualize it on the midline. And I like to tell people, like, think of if you have a long sleeve shirt and you stick your finger under your shirt sleeve, then you can't literally see your finger unless you lift the finger, then you see the shape your finger makes within the shirt sleeve. That's sort of how posterior tie works, is if you get behind, I always do my examinations looking, I'm at the baby's head and like, so kind of upside down looking into the mouth, and I'm lifting that tongue up and back towards the back of the mouth. And those posterior ties, and you'll see that fascia connective tissue gather, and you're like, oh yeah, there it is. If you're the untrained person, it could be, like I said, really totally invisible. And those are the ones, like I said, sometimes cause more problems than some of the more obvious anatomic restrictions. So that's where a lot of those get missed. If there's not an obvious string to the tip of the tongue, then it gets dismissed as, oh, there's not a tongue tie. Because the baby can stick their tongue out, or they can move their tongue. But that gets into where there's compensation. So a lot of the other musculoskeletal system can compensate for the lack of mobility with the oral restrictions. And so that's where also a lot of things get missed, because humans are very good at compensating.
That's what we're born to do, right?
Yeah.
That's how we survive.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Okay, I have, this is kind of out of the order of our questions, but I had a gal reach out to me. She had her baby's tongue tie released at 4.5 months, and she actually had her tongue tie released. And she said they took measurements of her like leaning over and touching her toes before the tongue tie. And she was 3 inches away from even touching the ground. And then immediately after getting her tongue tie released, she could put her knuckles on the ground. Is that real life?
Yeah. yeah, for sure. I know, I just mentioned fascia, and fascia is connective tissue that invests throughout the entire body. It touches its own nerve and blood supply. And basically, like our muscles would just get a much fascia connective tissue that gave it its shape. And the tongue is part of a functional unit of fascia called the deep front line. If you Google deep front line fascia, there's this amazing video where they've got a dissection of this fascia laid out on a table, and they go from the tips of the toes through the ankles, the knees, the hips, the deep core and pelvic floor muscles, up through the diaphragm and the lungs, the heart, and it comes up through the neck, and then it ends in the tongue. And the tongue is just like massive. And they're like, well, this is the most forward thrusting part of the visceral cell is the tongue. And so, I mean, that's a real deal. It's something that there's not a lot of research historically about fascia. It's sort of newer on the scene. I mean, I took anatomy and physiology lab in dental school where we dissected a cadaver, and we didn't study fascia. We just cut it away to look at the muscles and the bones and the nerves and the blood vessels, which were considered the things you were supposed to study. But as more and more knowledge comes about fascia, we find that it's an extremely important, if not more important than some of the other structures we traditionally studied. And so, yeah, I'd say the tongue is one of the kings of the fascia system.
It's so crazy.
I just, now I have to get my tongue tie released just to see if it's real.
So you can touch your toes.
I can't touch my toes no matter how much I stretch. I cannot touch my toes.
See, I can touch my toes and I'm fine.
But do you have a tongue tie?
I don't know. Probably not, since I can touch my toes.
Well, maybe you compensated to touch your toes. But I do have a picture of a great case I did on a male in his 60s where at the back of his neck had a crease and a bulge and kind of a forward head posture. And immediately after the procedure, I had set him up. We took another photo, like a profile picture, and that crease and bulge was gone. Like it immediately released. His whole face and neck was visibly immediately transformed and much more relaxed.
That's so interesting.
That's,
I'm just picturing all the people I know who I'm like, oh, I wonder.
I know. Well, I had talked with someone yesterday who's like, husband had swallowing deficits and sleep deficits, and I was like, it's probably a tongue tie. She's like, yeah, it probably is.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's my question. If you think either your child or yourself has a tongue tie, what the heck do you do?
I mean, like you kind of talked about, it can be, you have to find the right team, and it does take a team. And so I don't want people to get the idea that the tongue tie is the end-all be-all. It's usually a sign that there's multiple overlapping issues with the body. Usually the tongue tie can be just the tip of the iceberg. So there's a lot of things usually involved with it, like myofunctional therapy, which is like tongue and lip and cheek and swelling exercises, and it can be, involve speech therapy, it can involve body work, craniosacral therapy or chiropractic or physical therapy, or specifically people that can manipulate fascia. There's basically, you have to find providers that are really aware and gung-ho, and I found there's typically there's, like myself, you know, people that have had personal experience with their own family, themselves or their own family, those are the folks that are more tuned in to this. So, I mean, the last thing you want to do is find somebody that says, oh, I don't really believe in all this stuff, but I'll do a tongue tie release for you. If they're not really on the same page, then it's probably not the right type of person to seek out. So
I think that's the biggest thing, is getting the team and finding people who will tell you how it is and not just do the tongue tie release just to do it. You know, is it actually affecting function? Would it be beneficial to everyone to get it released, or are we functioning okay? You know, I'm a functioning adult. I have a tongue tie and I'm surviving, but could my function be improved? You know, and I think that's what we need to think about with our kiddos as well. And from an occupational therapy standpoint, it's our goal to make the child or the adult we're working with live the most functional, happy, healthy life. So we have to we have to take that into consideration when we're looking into this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the talking, going back to optimal health, you have to decide if you're, if that's what you're going for, if you want to move towards optimal health, or if you're okay being normal, you know, and that's okay.
Being normal.
Just a lot of people aren't aware of what's possible, so they don't know what's at stake. They don't know how well they could be. Right. I think we're thinking more of adults here now, too. One thing that's quite a bit different, we can show a contrast here, is one reason it's great to treat infants, and I would say that like the best age to treat is about 5 days old.
Oh, wow.
Maybe a bit earlier than that, but 5 days old, you know, a few weeks old, I actually see a huge difference in the amount of the thickness and texture and restriction of the tissue between 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months. It gets exponentially thicker and tougher and tighter at the anatomy that I'm actually releasing. Plus, the baby's already learned lots of complications, and so the quicker you can get them on an optimal path of development, the better. But the good thing about infants is they have so much growth potential. I mean, let's say you release a five-day-old, and they're doing functional breastfeeding. They're growing their mid-face. If the face is growing forward and wide, that's going to support and enhance their airway so they can breathe better and they can sleep better. And eventually, they'll be able to smile better because they'll have more room for well-aligned teeth that function with their bite and their jaw joint. So now if we think of an adult that goes their whole life without having the tongue tie release when they needed it, the process is much different. Instead of just releasing the tongue and having, you know, some of that support, but then more of a natural progression of optimal health, you have to do a CT scan, look at your way, look at the joints of the teeth. It becomes more of a puzzle to figure out how to help the adult and make sure you're not leaving a weak link in the chain. Because if someone has a tongue tie release, but maybe they have a tiny airway, and they don't have enough room for the tongue in their mouth, they might need other things first before you release the tongue.
Interesting. Yeah, so that's why it's good to not just go to someone who will release it. You want to find someone who will look at the whole picture.
So why isn't there someone like you in the hospitals checking on all the newborn babies?
I think that gets kind of political or like... bureaucracy kind of thing. I think it's just, there's sort of a way of doing things. I know, just speaking from personal experience, when my third son was born, you know, my wife and I had seen the lip tie and the tongue tie. Anatomically, it was fairly prominent. So the first day, I'm in the hospital, looks like he has a lip tie and a tongue tie. It wasn't a functional issue or symptoms at that point because he was so new, or if he really hadn't, you know, his first day. But we asked the lactation consultant in the hospital, hey, what do you think? It looks like he has a lip tie and a tongue tie. And she said, I'm not allowed to say anything about that. So that's a real thing, that there are rules about what people can and can't say. And I think there's sort of the idea that in the hospital system, they don't want a lactation consultant to worry the parents because they want the pediatrician to be the authority. And then maybe the patient pediatrician refers to an ENT, kind of in hospital, in network. And so I think that's kind of what it boils down to, is there's organizational systems that at the end of the day can limit access to that optimal care.
It sucks because it's the same in the school systems, and it's the same even, you know, in a clinic practice, that you can't recommend certain things. You can say, oh, well, maybe, but even that gets tricky.
Yeah.
I hate it.
I do too. Another common question we'll get is for a lip tie, my child will just fall. They'll just bust their lip tie on their own. You know, we don't need to get it cut because that's just unnecessary trauma. They'll just fall and, you know, split it on their own.
Yeah. I don't get that one at all. I'm just like, what? I don't see that could be a valid recommendation. But part of it, I mean, I guess, you know, if it's not something to deal with, it just is a story that gets passed down. But one thing I think of is whenever I have, maybe a mom reaches out to me through my website or calls and they said, oh, my baby has a lip tie. And I'm like, well, you know, where there's a lip tie, there's almost certainly a tongue tie. And so that's the other reason why I don't would advocate just letting the lip split on its own, because the lip is often the more visible sign that there's an oral restriction, and those midline defects can go together. And so it's really a nice opportunity to say, anatomically, you see a lip tie, then I would say, you know, 99% of the time, there's a tongue tie that is probably limiting function, causing symptoms, you know, if you know which symptoms to look for, and therefore an opportunity to get both treated as early as possible and improve the quality of life from the time of the treatment throughout the rest of their development.
Yes.
There's a huge window of opportunity you'd be missing if you're like, we're just going to wait for it to rip, you know? But like I said, I would say that would be great if more people thought of that, that the lip tie is the more visible of the pair that will give you the, I need to look into this deeper.
We just want to take a minute and talk to you about our company, Harkla. Our mission at Harkla is to help those with special needs live happy, healthy lives. Not only do we accomplish this through the podcast, but we also have therapy products, easy-to-follow digital courses, and the Harkla Sensory Club to try to bring holistic care to you and your family.
Listeners of the All Things Sensory podcast get 10% off their first purchase at Harkla with the discount code SENSORY. We'd recommend checking out some of our best sellers like the Compression Sensory Swing, Weighted Blankets, or our course on sensory diets.
And here's the best part. 1% of each sale gets donated to the University of Washington Autism Center to support autism research and fund scholarships to families in need to receive in-clinic therapy for their child.
Learn more about Harkla and all we have to offer at harkla.co. That's harkla.co. And don't forget to use the discount code SENSORY to get 10% off your first purchase. That's SENSORY for 10% off.
And the best part is all Harkla orders come with a lifetime guarantee and free shipping.
You really can't beat that.
No,
you can't. Okay, let's get back to the show.
Okay, so say you take your child in and you get the tongue tie released. Will that tissue grow back and will it like reverse itself at some point? Or is that potentially a problem?
Yeah. I mean, there's always going to be healing. You want this wound to heal. And in the end of the day, a tongue tie release is creating a surgical wound to provide a release, but it's also going to heal. And the thing that can happen within the healing process is, would it heal in such a way that it restores the original restriction? And that is quite possible. So that's the reason why we recommend a pretty extensive and not so fun regimen of wound care and stretches, which the youngest son, but I watched my wife do it and it looked really hard. I guess it's a good time to mention that there's pectorectomy that's more commonly done, especially if it's by, say, a pediatrician in the hospital or maybe by a dentist who doesn't do a lot of pectorectomy work, is it would clip or snip the anterior portion of the tongue tie. So it's sort of like a quick and easy and bloodless procedure. But the problem with a lot of those is they don't provide a functional release of the tongue. And so when you have a proper tongue tie release, there's going to be a diamond-shaped wound. You might even be able to see some muscle. We don't cut the muscle, but we release the mucosa, which is the skin and the fascia underneath it, and you'll see a pretty sizable diamond-shaped wound. And I tell my patients the goal is to do the wound care where that is elongating and getting more vertical. And it's going to want to sort of collapse down horizontally and attach to the mouth. So that's where that reattachment would come in, is that if the healing is unguided, then it could reattach, and theoretically there could be scar tissue that even made the restriction worse than before the procedure. So I tell people in some cases, if you couldn't commit to the wound care, then you might be better off not getting it done. I mean, I'd hope, because of what's at stake with the breathing and the sleep and the development and all those things, that someone would go for it. But there's probably cases where maybe someone would actually have to step back and say, you know, maybe it's not for you.
Yeah.
That's a good point, because those first couple of weeks, I mean, if you're not in their mouth every couple of hours, it's hard, but I mean, it's so quick and you just get in, get out, and you're on the way.
And it's not forever.
No, but I can see that if they can't commit to it, then you might be better off not doing it depending on the case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Okay. We've jumped around everywhere.
Yeah. So let's just give our listeners kind of an idea of how long the procedure takes, and then just like a quick overview of the recovery. Like, when should we expect that optimal function afterwards?
Yeah. Well, in my office, I book patients in for an hour. I have a private client lounge room. It's a private room. So basically the families are there for the preoperative discussion and demonstrating the wound care. I have a lactation consultant here in the office that helps with these cases. So it's a team approach inside my office. Not all offices work that way, but I find that team approach is really, really beneficial. And, you know, the actual procedure, we do take the baby down to the operatory where we have the laser and all the laser safety goggles and everything. So we swaddle the baby, and the actual lasering is just, I would say, a few seconds. It's under a minute for sure. So the baby's in the operatory maybe 5 minutes total, and they're back to mom. One of the goals of the procedure, the reason we have the lactation consultant present, is to hopefully get the baby to latch immediately after the procedure. And sometimes we'll see that especially if the mom has had a symptom of pain with nursing, in some cases that pain is gone immediately. Sometimes the babies are not interested in nursing. They might be a little numb from the topical anesthetic, or they might be in a little bit of shock from the procedure. Sometimes we've been having a weight check done by the lactation consultant, where they'll show that the baby that's been transferring two small amounts of milk will all of a sudden, immediately after the procedure, transfer more milk, have like the best feed they've ever had. So that's pretty rewarding. Something, obviously, I don't guarantee it, but it's always fun when it happens, and it happens fairly regularly. So what then we see is that the symptoms that have been present will sometimes quickly and then some gradually improve over the next few days and weeks following the procedure.
And so with the recovery, we see improvements over the next couple of weeks. What happens if we aren't consistently doing those like post-operative stretches and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, basically symptoms can come back.
Okay.
And then you have to look at the wound and see, is there evidence of reattachment?
Okay.
And again, so it kind of feeds back. You know, initially we're looking at symptoms and not symptom appearance, and that's still our guide. Is our symptoms resolving, or did they resolve and come back? But I would say once you get past the first couple of weeks, it's not likely that for symptoms returning would be from any kind of reattachment, because the oral cavity heals usually in about 2 weeks pretty completely. Mm. So that's also why it's important. Most of my patients are doing some sort of body work in addition to the lactation support. So they're seeing a chiropractor, opinion psychotherapist that's helping to mobilize the tissues and provide the sensory integration.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Have you ever had a client come in and say, hey, I think my child has a tongue tie, and you look and you recommend not getting the release done?
I haven't had that happen personally, but I think that's partly just being known as sort of a go-to for tongue tie, is that I see people that have already been self-screened, or they are being referred by a lactation consultant. So they've got the symptoms, that's why they're reaching out to me. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't do just exams on a baby to look at it and see if there's a problem. So even if people call me and they haven't reached out to someone else first, then typically I'm referring them, recommending they see a lactation consultant first. Because there can be issues with just the things they're skilled in, the positioning and all the things lactation consultants do that can help. But also if they decide to proceed to a revision or a tongue tie release, then that support is really helpful in preparing them. But also the body work too. I mean, there's babies that have torticollis, they have tight tissues, there's fascia that can be restricted, that can be mobilized and helped. And there may be some cases where they have body work and lactation support, and from those interventions, those support, they don't end up needing a tongue tie release. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's great. I'd rather, if that's possible, then they don't even get to me. So, yeah, I'd say, again, just go by symptoms and And I definitely want people to be prepared before they get to the stage of the release. So it's really important to have that team in place.
But what about for an adult? An adult wouldn't go see a lactation consultant.
Oh, no. So yeah, for an adult, I do a new patient exam. So it basically involves a CT scan, a radiology report, and we take photographs and measurements, intraoral scan. We're doing range of motion tests. So it's kind of mentioned earlier, it's a different ballgame. And then we're looking to see, do they have low tongue posture? So on the CT scan, we can see where they're holding their tongue. So some people have a low tongue posture, and that can be a good sign that actually if we release the tongue, there's room for it to move up and forward and actually open up their airway. So, and that kind of, I guess, is a good point to mention that everything I do in my practice, I call it airway dental medicine. And the goal is that we want to support and enhance the airway. And that's specifically the upper airway. So basically, anatomically, the tube you breathe through that's from the voice box up behind your tongue, behind your nose, and your soft palate. So below the voice box, you know, in our trachea, we've got rings of cartilage that support the airway so that when we breathe in, it doesn't collapse. But the upper airway is highly collapsible. And a lot of that is because mouths are too small, tongues are normal size, but basically you say you have a tongue that's too big for your mouth just because of small jaws. And then the airway is too small and often not very resilient, and then it's likely to collapse. And that's where people have breathing issues. And then at night, the tongue mainly is the culprit that can block the airway, because when you go and try to go into deep sleep, your muscles get more relaxed. That's normal behavior, but when your mouth is too crowded, then the tongue can block the airway. So even when people are young, young females, younger men can have sleep problems, unrefreshing sleep, insomnia. It's throughout life, and it takes a long time before someone actually gets severe enough where they might be diagnosed with sleep apnea. So that's the other thing, is a lot of people treat obstructive sleep apnea, but I see this airway dysfunction as a whole spectrum of objectively identifiable anatomic issues as well as symptoms that you can identify from birth all the way until someone's a fat old man at 60 that gets diagnosed with sleep apnea. Wow. So I really enjoy working with people at any stage of their adult life to support and enhance the airway and give a better quality of life so they can, you know, breathe better and sleep better and smile better. Mm-hmm. So the other thing I guess I would mention is that when we have optimal development, we should develop dental arches that accommodate all 32 teeth, and they should be in good alignment. So just if someone has crowded teeth, you know they don't have a big enough jaw to support their teeth and a healthy airway. So if anybody's had crowded teeth, braces, or had braces and then the teeth got crowded again, or they had extractions, wisdom tooth extractions, those are all signs that they don't have an optimal airway. And then the other thing I look at is the actual shape of the teeth. And so if you look at teeth, you can see that's one of the most objective parts of the body, because you can measure, those are genetic tooth forms. And we can say, oh, you know, your central incisor should be 12 millimeters long, and now it's only 8, so we know exactly how much has been worn away. That's the other thing that happens with adults, is they clench and grind and have acid erosion that wears down your teeth. And it's like you're losing functional anatomy, and that has consequences. So a big part of what I do with adults is we actually restore the teeth to their original form, and then that allows their bite and their jaw joint to work together to support and enhance their airway.
So it literally is all connected.
Oh, so many things. Well, I was just thinking of myself when you were talking about that. I was like, oh yeah, I had braces, and then I had my wisdom teeth removed as an adult, and now my teeth are like still a little bit, I guess, crowded or crooked, yeah. Right? And I'm like, oh crap.
Yeah, no, it's a great thing with the CT scan. We can visualize if you're breathing through a tube that's more like a straw or a snorkel. Of course, we want it to be more like a snorkel and not a straw, but I see a lot of people breathing through tubes or upper airways the size of a straw, and that kind of stands to reason that that might impact your quality of life.
Just a little bit.
Well, I was going to say, they're probably in fight or flight constantly because their body can't get enough oxygen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that compensating for a small airway is one of the biggest causes of chronic stress and fight or flight. And so if someone's in a prolonged state of fight or flight or sympathetic tone, then that's going to bleed into all kinds of other chronic health issues. So I'm trying to find a slide here. Okay, this is like a typical young, fit female who's not like the fat old man with the big neck that you might think of having sleep apnea, or they call upper airway resistance syndrome, which is, I call it airway dysfunction. It's a small airway where you're trying to compensate. But here's one kind of list of symptoms that, especially a young, fit female, you might be experiencing is chronic fatigue, headaches, anxiety, depression, low blood pressure, cold hands and feet, hypothyroidism, and digestive issues.
Okay, I'm fine.
So that was one. I would see this over and over. It's like, oh, yeah. And then there's usually exits. A tongue ties, small jaws, small airway, and then that feeds into that particular center picture.
That's insane. That's amazing.
It's amazing how it affects your entire life, not just your mouth, your breathing, your talking.
Yeah, it's everything.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I heard a good quote. Someone said in the mouth, you know, because your teeth are sensory organs and there's nerves that feed back and it's cranial nerves fit into your brain. It's one of the areas of highest neurological density. So, of course, the whole head and neck is, but your jaws and your teeth do interact with your proprioception, your vision, and your head posture staying level. But even a lot of people are posturing their head forward to open up their airway. Because if you kind of lean your head forward and tip your chin up, that's going to enlarge and tension the airway, so it's likely to collapse. So a lot of the postural issues are related to small airways. And that's why a lot of people can't just tuck their chin, because then it would collapse the airway. So they're going to not have good posture because they have to survive. And I like to say, if you think about it, there's really nothing more important than your next breath.
Wow. And for everyone listening, you couldn't see Jessica and I just now, but tucking our chins and moving up,
thrusting my head forward.
Everyone else going through this too right now.
I can describe this too. It's kind of going to be you're going to either like it or not like it.
Oh.
It can be you won't be able to unsee this. Okay, but I'll do it anyway. So if you look around, especially you want to look at people's profile, okay, looking at someone from the front, they're going to move their head so everybody kind of looks normal. But if you look from the side, here, I'll do it on mine. If you look at me from the side, my forehead is sort of sloped. It has an angle to it. Uh-huh. You see that?
Yeah.
So theoretically, forehead should be vertical. And so whenever I look at someone, like in an airport or out and about, if they have a sloped forehead, I think, wow, they have a huge craniofacial compensation to keep their airway open through their whole life. And this is like, it changes throughout life. And so when I look at someone, I say, if their forehead was vertical, then how far back in their face would their jaws be? That's a more clear picture, a non-compensated picture of their craniofacial development. And so you'll see, like, when I put my forehead vertical, my jaws are actually a lot farther back than they are when I have my habitual head posture. So it gives you a more true picture of the problem.
Wow.
Jeez. That's pretty crazy. Okay. I said earlier I had one more question. Now I really do have one more question. And then unfortunately, we have to let you go. Is it genetic? Are tongue ties genetic? You said your three boys went through this, and then you're talking about your forehead. So what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a genetic component. I see more boys than girls that have tongue ties and lip ties. So I think there's a male predominance. There's a big, you get in the weeds too much, but I've learned a lot more about epigenetics. And I guess the simple way to say that is, I used to think 80%, I'd say nature versus nurture, right? Or environment versus genetics. So I'd say, you know, is it 80% genetics and 20% environment? And now I think it's sort of opposite. It's like 20% genetics and 80% environment. But the other little twist in that is our human genome doesn't change very quickly. It takes many thousands or millions of years. So what we're seeing with inherited issues, I think, is epigenetics or gene expression, where a baby can inherit a tongue tie from a parent, but it's more based around gene expression, not around any kind of evolutionary change. But we are seeing kids inherit the smaller jaws and tongue ties from their parents or from their ancestors. Does that make sense? So it's kind of both. But I would say the good news is, if you then believe that it's 80% environment, then there's a lot we can do to intervene, but then have proper gene expression, which is, again, why we want to intervene in infancy, ideally, because theoretically an infant who has a functional tongue tie release, has functional breastfeeding, optimal breastfeeding, their muscle activity is going to stimulate their jawbones to grow to the full genetic potential. When we talk about weaning, you have to wean onto harder foods, which is sort of hard to do in our modern world. But if you have good lip posture, tongue up, lips closed, breathing through the nose, chewing hard foods, having good posture, all these things can help a child develop optimally, where they wouldn't braces and tongue tie release and surgery and all these things. So that is the potential if we can catch it early, to help someone grow more optimally and not have to suffer needlessly.
And then also not pass down this continuous cycle.
Yeah.
We could just keep talking forever.
I know.
There's so many questions.
It's interesting. And I love that we can connect adults and infants, you know, and we can realize that it's not just related to babies. And this isn't just an episode for parents, you know, it's an episode for everyone to be aware of and to just have that knowledge in the backseat and keep it in mind.
Yeah. Jeez.
All right. Yeah. Before we let you go, your last like one piece of advice that you could leave our listeners with today.
Yeah, I would say, and maybe especially for moms who have these babies with issues, I would say trust your gut, trust your intuition, and find someone that'll listen. And it's really about symptoms more than appearance. Mm-hmm. So it's not about what the tongue tie or lip tie looks like. It's about trusting your gut and knowing if there are functional issues, there's symptoms, then you should seek help from someone who knows how to evaluate based on symptoms and not just the appearance.
Gotcha. Awesome. Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Sam. Dr. Zink. Do you have any questions for us before we let you go?
I don't think so. I think that was really good. That was really enjoyable.
Perfect. All right. Well, we appreciate you sharing your time with us.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Did everybody learn as much as we did?
Did you try all the things as he's like talking about them? Like we looked at each other's foreheads.
Yeah, we changed our posture.
Yep. And then later on, after this interview was done, we took a break to eat lunch. And Rachel's husband, Daniel, was down there. I was like, Daniel, turn to the side. Let me see your forehead. And can I share?
Yeah.
His forehead's a little bit slanted.
It is. Yes. He's also a terrible sleeper as well. Ooh, so are we going to connect the dots?
He probably has a tongue tie. Well, and there's a genetic component potentially. So
I have a tongue tie, as we found out.
Yeah. So, I think I'm fine.
Are you?
I think
you don't have any issues.
No. Okay. See, and this is the thing. You have vestibular challenges. You have a tongue tie.
I can't touch my toes.
You can't touch your toes. I am fully integrated vestibularly. The only reflex I don't have integrated is my Babinski. Yes. Pretty sure, like, I keep putting my tongue to the roof of my mouth. I'm pretty sure I'm fine there. My teeth are a little crooked, whatever.
You sleep good?
I sleep so good. Yes. I love sleep. It's like my favorite thing to do.
It's your favorite occupation.
Is sleep. I love my bed. Okay, oh my gosh, we're rambling.
Yes. So that's the point, is like function, right? Look at the function. Listen to this episode. We actually have a bonus episode with an IBCLC coming at you Friday to kind of explore this topic a little bit more in detail.
Yep.
So if you don't know what an IBCLC is, maybe you should listen to that episode.
Yeah. In the meantime, leave us a review on iTunes. Shout us out on Instagram, All Things Sensory Podcast. Let us know you're listening. And I think that's it.
All right. We'll talk to you on Friday.
Thank you so much for listening to All Things Sensory by Harkla. If you want more information on anything we mentioned in the show, head over to harkla.co/podcast to get all of the show notes.
We always have the show notes and links, plus full transcripts to make following along as easy as possible for everyone. If you have follow-up questions, the best place to ask those is in the comments on the show notes or message us on our Instagram account, which is @Harkla_family. If you just search Harkla, you'll find us.
Like we mentioned before, our podcast listeners get 10% off their first order at Harkla, whether it's for one of our digital courses, one of our sensory swings. The discount code SENSORY will save you 10%. That code is SENSORY. Head over to harkla.co/sensory to use that code right now so you don't forget.
We're so excited to work together to help create confident kids all over the world and work towards a happier, healthier life.
All right, we'll talk to you guys next week.